Well, hello, and welcome to the Cory Doctorow podcast. Today is the 20th of April, and I am sat in front of my computer at my office, having just finished the day's work on For the Win, the novel I'm working on, which is going extremely well, and I'm about to record another podcast for you, another section of reading from my novel, 2005 novel, Someone Comes to Town, Someone Leaves Town, initially published by Tor Books in 2005, soon to be published in the UK by HarperCollins. I think I mentioned this before. HarperCollins has bought all of my novels under their Voyager imprint, and they've just given me word on when they're going to be publishing the backlist titles, Down and Out in the Magic Kingdom, Eastern Standard Tribe, and Someone Comes to Town, Someone Leaves to Town. That'll be in the summer of 2010, and it will coincide with the paperback release of my next novel, Makers, which they'll be publishing in hardcover in October, along with Tor Books. If you followed all of that, you're better than I am. Anyway, some news before I go on. I'm just getting ready now to go and give a talk tomorrow afternoon at the London Book Fair. I'm going to be doing a 20 slides in 20 minutes presentation as part of a big group presentation organized by some book promoters. That should be fun. I'm also continuing work on, with a little help, the short story collection I'm planning. That will be my first on-demand self-published venture. Never really tried this before, but I figured I might as well give it a shot after getting some galleys printed up for my next book at Lulu and seeing just how amazingly good those Lulu books looked and how cheap they were. They cost less than going up to the photocopy shop here in my office in London and having them printed and spiral-bound. Anyway, the latest bit of news is my agent, Russ Galen, has been back to me, and he really likes the idea and had some very challenging feedback on my business plan, and we're really going at it hammer and tongs now, and I think that I'll be ready to release that business plan very soon, which will be very exciting. This Friday, speaking of exciting, this Friday and Saturday is the Nebula Awards weekend in Los Angeles at UCLA. I won't be there, although I'm a nominee this year for Best Novel for my novel Little Brother. Instead, my friend Will Wheaton is going to be there on my behalf on Saturday night, and if I win, he will read you a little speech. And if I don't win, I may just read that speech into my podcast next week, just for the record. I continue to write a lot of nonfiction these days. It's been a really busy time for nonfiction. I'm turning in a column or two a week, and I've got columns stacked up for the next couple of months, just a whole whack of them. Just seems like there's a lot of stuff that needs commenting on and a lot of thinking kind of going somewhere in my head, gelling into bigger pieces. So I'll keep publishing those. If you follow me on Twitter or if you read my blog, if you read craphound.com, you can find complete listings of all those columns as they're published. Some good news. I think that this is now public. I just saw someone tweet it, so I'm thinking it's public. The BookSense, which is now called something like IndieNet, this is the network of 1,000 independent bookstores in the United States, has just given its Indies Choice Awards for the year. These are the best-selling favorite hand-sold books of 2008. For the independent bookstores in America, and the best-selling young adult book, their Indies Choice, goes to Little Brother, my novel, which is fantastic. Thank you to all of you who went out and patronized those stores and found yourself doing me the favor of buying them and getting me this award. It's very, very cool news, not least because it means that all of those stores now order several more copies and prominently display them. You get a kind of virtuous circle out of this. Let's see, what other announcements? Well, some brickbats and some cheers. As you know, I'm working on this novel For the Win, which is about gaming and gold farming, and I'm playing a variety of multiplayer online games, some at the same time, some in serial, to research this book as I go. And one that I've been playing lately is World of Warcraft, except I'm not playing it anymore, because Blizzard, the company that makes it, a division of Vivendi, they've just updated, pushed out an 800 megabyte update that broke World of Warcraft for me. I'd been playing it under a Linux product called Crossover, which is a commercial version of Wine, a program that lets you run Windows software under Linux, and it broke this. And the Crossover people have been working with me, but I've actually reinstalled WoW, which is kind of a huge deal. It's gigabytes and gigabytes of storage that it takes up, most of which have to be downloaded in the form of patches, and it's still not working. So if any of you Well, actually, forget that. I don't want more Linux support on this. I've got as much Linux support as I can handle. It's kind of flaky, and your situation isn't my situation. The fact that you've got it running on your video card won't help me, so don't bother sending me advice about that. The other Brickbat and Laurel I have here are for Barclays Bank here in the UK. I realized that I was paying these gigantic fees to Barclays Bank, where I do my business banking here in the UK, primarily for foreign exchange stuff, and that they were taking forever to clear checks. I was depositing checks, you know, drawn on Bank of America from Amazon, which, you know, this is hardly a kind of difficult to understand check or a suspicious check. And they sit on it for 6 weeks, 8 weeks, 10 weeks before clearing the funds into my account, all the while racking up interest on it. So after a bunch of research with help from the people who follow me on Twitter, I investigated all of the major banks in the UK and found out how their fees compared, and I've decided to switch my banking to the Co-op, which is also one of the most ethical banks in the UK and one of the few that didn't experience problems as a result of the econopocalypse. So any of you who do small business stuff in the UK and have to deal with foreign currencies, my recommendation thus far is to go to the Co-op. They're really lovely. And then the last piece here is I saw this morning that my friend Darren Brown, a well-known conjurer, stage magician, mentalist, has a new show that he's opening that he's touring the UK with called The Enigma, and it looks terrific. Alice and I saw his last show a year ago this May. It was actually the day that we had our civic wedding, so we went to City Hall and got married before having our actual great big wedding. And that night, to celebrate, we went out and saw Darren's show and had dinner with him, and it was just a terrific show. He's an amazing mentalist, really mind-bending. And we're going to go see this new show in June, and so if you're in the UK, he's touring the whole country, I suggest going to see it. He has my wholehearted uncompensated, unsolicited recommendation. He's terrific. So anyway, that's enough for matter here. I will now read to you from Someone Comes to Town, Someone Leaves Town, my 2005 tour novel, soon to be a 2010 HarperCollins UK Voyager novel. "Don't bother," Andy said. "Seriously, it's not worth it. We'll just find somewhere else to locate the repeater. It's not worth all the bullshit you're getting." "Screw that. They told me that they'd take one. They're the ones I talked into it. My contribution to the effort. And they're fucking anarchists. They've got to be into this. It's totally irrational." Kurt was almost crying. "I don't want to screw up your friendships, Kurt. They'll come around on their own. You're just turning yourself inside out over this, and it's not worth it. Come on, it's cool." He turned around his laptop and showed the picture to Kurt. "Check it out. People with tails. An entire gallery of them." There were lots of pictures like that on the net. None of people without belly buttons, though. Kurt took a pull off his beer. "Disgusting," he said, and clicked through the gallery. The Greek looked over their shoulder. "It's real?" "It's real, Larry," Alan said. "Freaky, huh?" "That's terrible," the Greek said. "Pah!" There were five or six other network users out on the Greeks, but it was early yet. By 5:30, there'd be 50 of them. Some of them brought their own power strips so that they could share juice with their co-religionists. "You really want me to give up?" Kurt asked, once the Greek had given him a new beer and a scowling look over the litter of picked-at beer label on the table before him. "I really think you should," Alan said. "It's a poor use of time." Kurt looked ready to cry again. Adam had no idea what to say. "Okay," Kurt said. "Fine." He finished his beer in silence and slunk away. But it wasn't fine, and Kurt wouldn't give it up. He kept on beating his head against the blank wall, and every time Alan saw him, he was grimmer than the last. "Let it go," Adam said. "I've got to deal with the vacuum cleaner repair guy across the street." A weird but sweet old Polish Holocaust survivor who'd listened attentively to Andy's pitch before announcing that he'd been watching all the hardware go up around the market, and he'd simply been waiting to be included in the club. That'll cover that corner just fine. "I'm going to throw a party," Kurt said, "here in the shop. No, I'll rent out one of the warehouses in Oxford. I'll invite them, the kids, everyone who's let us put up an access point, a big mill and swill. Buy a couple kegs. No one can resist free beer." Alan had started off frustrated and angry with Kurt, but this drew him up and turned him around. "That's a fine idea," he said. "We'll invite Lyman." Lyman had taken to showing up at Alan's stoop in the morning sometimes, on his way to work, for a cup of coffee. He'd taken to showing up at Kurt's shop in the afternoon sometimes, on his way home from work, to marvel at the kids' industry. His graybeard had written some code that analyzed packet loss and tried to make guesses about the crowd density in different parts of the market, and Lyman took a proprietary interest in it, standing out by Bikes on Wheels or the Portuguese furniture store and watching the data on his PDA, comparing it with the actual crowds on the street. He'd only hesitated for a second when Andrew asked him to be the inaugural advisor on ParasiteNet's board, and once he'd said yes, it became clear to everyone that he was endlessly fascinated by their little adhocracy and its experimental telco potential. "This sounds like a great idea," he said. He was buying the drinks because he was the one with the $500 glasses and a full suspension racing bike. "Look at that," he said. From the Greek's front window, they could see Oxford Street and a little of Augusta, and Lyman loved using his PDA and his density analysis software where he sat while he sat, looking from his colored map to the crowd scene. "Look at the truck as it goes down Oxford and turns up Augusta. That signature is so distinctive I could spot it in my sleep. I need to figure out how to sell this to someone. Maybe the cops or something." He tipped Andy a wink. Kurt opened and shut his mouth a few times, and Lyman slapped his palm down on the table. "You look like you're gonna bust something," he said. "Don't worry, kid. Damn, you've got some big, easy-to-push buttons." Kurt made a face. "You wanted to sell our stuff to luxury hotels. You tried to get us to present at the Sky Dome. You're capable of anything." "The Sky Dome would be a great venue for this stuff," Lyman said, settling into one of his favorite variations on Bait the Anarchist. "The Sky Dome was built with tax dollars that should have been spent on affordable housing, then was turned over to rich pals of the Premier for a song, who then ran it into the ground, got bailed out by the province, and then it got turned over to different rich pals. You can just shut up about the goddamn Sky Dome. You'd have to break both of my legs and carry me to get me to set foot in there."
"About the party," Adam said.
"About the party."
"Yes, certainly," Lyman said.
"Kurt, behave." Kurt belched loudly, provoking a scowl from the Greek. The Waldos all showed up in a bunch with plastic brown liter bottles filled with murky homebrew beer and a giant bag of skunkweed. The party had only been on for a couple hours, but it had already balkanized into inward-facing groups. Merchants, kids, hackers. Kurt kept turning the music way up. If they're not going to talk to one another, they might as well dance. "Kurt, these people are old. Old people don't dance to music like this." "Shut up, Lyman. Make me." And Andy kept turning it down. The bookstore people drifted in, then stopped and moved vaguely toward the middle of the floor, there to found their own breakaway conversational republic. Lyman startled. "Sarah?" he said, and one of the anarchists looked up sharply. "Lyman?" She had two short ponytails and a round face that made her look teenage young, but on closer inspection she was more Lyman's age, mid-30s. She laughed and crossed the gap to their little republic and threw her arms around Lyman's neck. "Crispy Christ, what are you doing here?"
"I work with these guys." He turned to Arnold and Kurt.
"This is my cousin Sarah," he said. "These are Albert and Kurt. I'm helping them out."
"Hi, Sarah," Kurt said.
"Hey, Kurt," she said, looking away. It was clear even to Alan that they knew each other already. The other bookstore people were looking on with suspicion, drinking their beer out of refillable coffee store thermos cups.
"It's great meeting you," Alan said, taking her hand in both of his and shaking it hard. "I'm really glad you folks came down."
She looked askance at him, but Lyman interposed himself.
"Now, Sarah, these guys really, really wanted to talk something over with you all, and they've been having a hard time getting a hearing."
Kurt and Alan traded uneasy glances. They'd carefully planned out a subtle easeway into this conversation, but Lyman was running with it.
"You didn't know I was involved, huh?"
"Surprised the hell out of me," Lyman said. "Will you hear them out?" She looked back at her collective. "What the hell? Yeah, I'll talk him into it."
"It starts with the sinking of the Titanic," Kurt said.
They'd arranged their mismatched chairs in a circle in the cramped back room of the bookstore, and were drinking and eating organic crumbly things with the taste and consistency of mud brick. Sarah told Kurt that they'd have 10 minutes, and Alan had told him that he could take it all. Alan had spent the day reading on the net, remembering the arguments that had swayed the most people, talking it over. He was determined that Kurt would win this fight.
"There's this ship going down, and it's signaling SOS, SOS, but the message didn't get out because the shipping lanes were full of other ships with other radios, radios that clobbered the Titanic signal. That's because there were no rules for radio back then, so anyone could light up any transmitter and send out any signal at any frequency. Imagine a room where everyone shouted at the top of their lungs nonstop, all the while setting off air horns. After that, they decided that Fed regulators would divide up the radio spectrum into bands and give those bands to exclusive licensees who'd know that their radio waves would reach their destination without being clobbered, because any clobberers would get shut down by the cops.
But today we got a better way. We can make radios that are capable of intelligently cooperating with each other. We can make radios that use databases or just finely tuned listeners to determine what bands are in use and what at any given moment in any place. They can talk between the gaps and other signals. They can relay messages for other radios. They can even try to detect the presence of dumb radio devices, TVs, and FM tuners, and grab the signal they're meant to be receiving off of the internet and pass it on, so that the dumb device doesn't even realize that the world has moved on. Now, the original radio rules were supposed to protect free expression, because if everyone was allowed to speak at once, no one would be heard. That may have been true, but it was a pretty poor system as it went. Mostly, the people who got radio licenses were cops, spooks, and media barons. There aren't a lot of average people using the airwaves to communicate for free with one another. There's not a lot of free speech. But now we have all this new technology where computers direct the operation of flexible radios, radios whose characteristics are determined by software, and it's looking like the scarcity of the electromagnetic spectrum has been pretty grossly overstated. It's hard to prove, because now we've got a world where lighting up a bunch of smart, agile radios is a crime against the legit license holders. But Parliament's not going to throw the airwaves open, because no elected politician can be responsible for screwing up the voters' televisions, because that's the surest fire way not to get re-elected. Which means that when you say, hey, our freedom of speech is being clobbered by bad laws, the other side can say, go study some physics, hippie, or produce a working network, or shut up. The radios we're installing now are about 1/1,000,000th as smart as they could be, and they use about 1/1,000,000th as much spectrum as they could without stepping on anyone's signal, but they're legal, and they're letting more people communicate than ever. There are people all over the world doing this, and whenever the policy wonks go to the radio cops to ask for more radio spectrum to do this stuff with, they parade people like us in front of them. We're like the Pinocchio's nose on the face of the radio cops. They say that only their big business buddies can be trusted with the people's airwaves, and we show them up for giant liars. He fell silent and looked at them. Adam held his breath. Sarah nodded and broke the silence. You know, that sounds pretty cool, actually. Kurt insisted on putting up that access point, while Alan and Lyman steadied the ladder. Sarah came out and joked with Lyman, and Alan got distracted watching them, trying to understand this notion of cousins. They had an easy rapport, despite all their differences, and spoke in a shorthand of family weddings long past and crotchety relatives long dead. So none of them were watching when Kurt overbalanced and dropped the Makita, making a wild grab for it, foot slipping off the rung, and toppled backwards. It was only Kurt's wild bark of panic that got Alan to instinctively move, to hold out his arms and look up, and he caught Kurt under the armpits and gentled him to the ground, taking the weight of Kurt's fall in a bone-jarring crush to his ribcage. "You okay?" Alan said, once he'd gotten his breath back. "Oof," Kurt said. "Yeah." They were cuddled together on the sidewalk, Kurt atop him, and Lyman and Sarah bent to help them apart. "Nice catch," Lyman said. Kurt was helped to his feet, and he declared that he'd sprained his ankle and nothing worse, and they helped him back to his shop, where a couple of his kids doted over him, getting him an ice pack and a pillow and his laptop and one of the many dumpster dive disc men from around the shop and some of the CDs of old punk bands that he favored. There he perched, growly as a wounded bear, master of his kingdom, for the next 2 weeks, playing online and going twitchy over the missed dumpsters going to the landfill every night without his expert picking over. Alan visited him every day and listened raptly while Kurt gave him the stats for the day's network usage, and Kurt beamed proud the whole while. One morning, Alan threw a clatter of toonies down on the Greek's counter and walked around the market, smelling the last night's staggering pissers and the morning's blossoms. Here were his neighbors, multicolored heads at the windows of their sagging house adjoining his, Link and Natalie in the adjacent windows farthest from his front door, Mimi's face suspicious at her window, and was that Krishna behind her, watching over her shoulder, hand between her wings, fingers tracing the scars depending from the muscles there? He waved at them. The reluctant winter made every day feel like a day before a holiday weekend. The bankers and the retail slaves coming in and out of the market had a festive air. He waved at the neighbors, and Link waved back, and then so did Natalie, and he hefted his sack of coffees from the Greek suggestively, and Mimi shut her curtains with a snap. But Natalie and Link smiled, and a moment later they were sitting in twig chairs on his porch in their jammies, watching the world go past as the sun began to boil the air and the coffee tasted as good as it smelled. Beautiful day, Natalie said, rubbing the duckling fuzz on her scalp and closing her eyes. Found any work yet? He said, remembering his promise to put her in touch with one of his fashionista proteges. She made a face. In a video store. Boring. Link made a rude noise. You are so spoiled. Not just any video store. She's working at Martian Signal on Queen Street. Alan knew it, a great shop with a huge selection of cult movies and a brisk trade in zines, transgressive literature, action figures, and t-shirts. It must be great there, he said. She smiled and looked away. It's okay. She bit her lip. I don't think I like working retail, she said. Ah, retail, he said. Retail would be fantastic if it wasn't for the fucking customers. She giggled. Don't let them get to you, he said. Get to be really smart about the stock, so there's always something you know more about than they do. And when that isn't true, get them to teach you more so you'll be in control next time. She nodded. And have fun with the computer when it's slow, he said. What? A store like that, it's got the home phone number of about 70% of the people in Toronto you'd ever wanted to hang out with. Most of your school friends, even the ones you've lost track with. All the things they've rented. All their old addresses. You can figure out who's living together, who gave their apartment to whom, all of that stuff. That kind of database is way more fun than you realize. You can get lost in it for months. She was nodding slowly. I can see that, she said. She upended her coffee and set it down. Listen, Arbus, she began, then bit her lip again. She looked at Link, who tugged at his fading pink shock of hair. It's nothing, he said. We get emotionally overwrought about friends and family. I have as much to apologize for as... Well, I owe you an apology. They stared at the park across the street, at the damaged wading pool where Edward had vanished. So, sorry's all round and kisses and hugs, and now we're all friends again, huh? Link said. Natalie made a rude noise and ruffled his hair, then wiped her hand off on his shirt. Alan, though, solemnly shook each of their hands in turn and thanked them. When he was done, he felt as though a weight had been lifted from him. Next door, Mimi's window slammed shut. "What is it you're doing around here, Aiken?" Link said. "I keep seeing you running around with ladders and tool belts. I thought you were a writer. Are you soundproofing the whole market?" "I never told you," Alan said. He'd been explaining wireless networking to anyone who could sit still, and had been beginning to believe that he'd run it down for every denizen of Kensington, but he'd forgotten to clue in his own neighbors. Right, he said. Are you seated comfortably? Then I shall begin. When we connect computers together, we call it a network. There's a big network of computers called the Internet. Even I know this, Natalie said. Shush, Alan said. I'll start at the beginning, where I started a year ago, and work my way forward. It's weird, it's big, and it's cool. And then he told them the story, the things he'd learnt from Kurt, the arguments he'd honed on the shopkeepers, the things Lyman had told him. So that's the holy mission, he said at last. You give everyone a voice and a chance to speak on a level playing field with the rich and powerful, and you make democracy, which is good. He looked at Link and Natalie, who were looking to one another rather intensely, communicating in some silent idiom of sibling body language. Played a shrimp, Natalie said. Funny coincidence, Link said. We were just talking about this yesterday. Spectrum? Alan quirked his eyebrows. No, not exactly, Natalie said. About making a difference. About holy missions. Wondering if there were any left. I mean, Link said, riding a bike or renting out videos are honest ways to make a living and all, and they keep us in beer and rent money, but they're not... Important, Natalie said. Ah, Alan said. Ah? Well, that's the thing we all want, right? Making a difference. Yeah. Which is why you went into fashion, Link said, giving her skinny shoulder a playful shove. She shoved him back. And why you went into electrical engineering. Okay, Alan said. It's not necessarily about what career you pick. It's about how you do what you do. Natalie, you told me that you used to shop at Tropicale. She nodded. You liked it. You used to shop there, right? Yeah. And it inspired you to go into fashion design. It also provided employment for a couple dozen people over the year. I sometimes got to help out little alternative girls from North Toronto buy vintage prom dresses at the end of the year, and I helped Motown Revival bands put together matching outfits of red blazers and wide trousers. Four or five little shops opened up nearby, selling the same kind of thing, imitating me. That whole little strip down there started with Tropicale. Natalie nodded. Okay, I knew that, I guess, but it's not the same as really making a difference, is it? Link flicked his butt to the curb. You're changing people's lives for the better either way. Exactly, Alan said. Then Link grinned, but there's something pretty, ballsy about this wireless thing, yeah? It's not the same.
Not the same, Alan said, grinning. It's better.
How can we help?